Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matter show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, there's a lot to talk about this week with, again, more primary results coming in from across the pond in the US as we seem to be hurtling towards that inevitable Clinton versus Trump race. We'll be discussing whether or not Donald Trump will get to that magic number of 1237 delegates or if it even matters. Meanwhile, back closer to home, we have the continuing debate over the EU referendum, where Ian Duncan Smith has thrown something of a spanner into the works, having resigned over an argument within the Conservative government over payments to disabled people. But what will be the fallout from that for George Osborne's ambitions and for the government more generally? And how has Labour responded and how should Labour respond in the future? Meanwhile, in the all-important horse race of voting intention, it does look like the Labour Party are taking a lead. But we'll be discussing how important that might be and what we can expect in the future. Today I'm joined by fellow podcasters and Polling Matters crew, Leo Barassi of Noise of the Crowd and Rob Vance of Penn Show in Berlin. Chaps, welcome.
Kieran.
Let's start with events across the pond in the first segment. I mean, yesterday we had a series of primaries and caucuses. The big story seemed to be in Arizona, where Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both won big. But it wasn't the full story. I mean, Rob, what did you make of yesterday?
I think the first thing to say is that all three states are solid, rock-solid Republican states. I'd be hugely surprised if the Democrats, regardless of who the presidential candidate is, was to go to the Democrats in the election. I think probably true to form. I mean, I think if you're a Democrat in Utah or Idaho, the chances are you're from the, let's say for the sake of argument, the more ideological wing of the party. And so a vote for and a support amongst the huge numbers of Democrats in those states supporting Sanders is probably not that surprising. I think, you know, a state like Arizona, Hillary's done pretty well. It's, you know, well organised. But ultimately, it doesn't tell us a huge amount about the race. I think the more interesting thing is on the Republican side, where we saw Cruz miss out, you know, quite significantly there. I have to say, last week, I thought he had a better chance than obviously he showed up there. But again, you know, a good night for Trump, continues to sort of, you know, accumulate the delegates, creeps on towards the nomination. No big surprises.
Let's look at the delegates because, I mean, as I think you've said, it does seem like it's all going to plan for those who expect a Clinton versus Trump race. Not maybe very much changing, I guess, Donald Trump inching towards that 498. Before we go on to the Republican race, because I want to talk a little bit about whether or not Donald Trump gets to that magic number of 1237. On the Democrat side, Hillary Clinton looks in a very strong position, but I guess Sanders had a decent night.
Well, he's kept the story going, right? I mean, at the end of the day, two caucus wins is two caucus wins and, you know, not to be sniffed at. But I think in reality, the kinds of numbers that you're able to notch up, I think I'm right in saying that Hillary's still the net delegate count winner from last night because Arizona's a slightly more popular state. So, you know, it doesn't make a huge difference. But he stays in the race, he stays in the narrative, he stays in the news. That's probably good for him and keeps his kind of, you know, point of view, you know, part of the conversation, which is not unhelpful for the Democrats, I think, actually, to keep, you know, they don't want to spend the entirety of the time debating, you know, Hillary just doing sort of set-piece events, you know, just bashing Trump. I don't think that's necessarily that good for the health of the party either.
I mean, let's look back at the Republicans. I was doing some sort of back of a fag packet maths earlier on today, looking at the delegates and looking at the map of you know, who's winning where, but also where the race is going to go. And to those watching this, on the left-hand side, we've got kind of the delegates that are up for grabs. It's quite complicated because, you know, some states are winner-takes-all, some are proportional, some are this kind of hybrid where it's winner-takes-all, yeah, at a congressional district level, but maybe not at the statewide level. But I was just doing some very crude calculations in my own mind to try and understand, you know, what the state of the race was. Now, Donald Trump needs to get to 498 more delegates. He needs 498 to win the 1237 sort of magic number. And I was just putting, like, I was looking at states that I thought he might win. I thought he might do well in Wisconsin, New York, a series of the northern states, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Rhode Island, but also further south in Virginia. And then I made a bit of a leap and talked about, I sort of thought, you know, Oregon and Washington, he'd do well. And then if you come, maybe New Mexico, because he's done well in Arizona, as we've talked about. And then we've come back to New Jersey, a state close to my heart. You know, he's probably going to do well there, given it neighbours New York. Now, if, as I rightly understand, you're not gonna, even if he won all of those states, he's not going to take all of the delegates. And that's not the way it works. But at the same time, if we just crudely gave him them, what we end up with is a situation where he has 419. Now, what this shows me is if you look at the states that I've left out, Indiana, Nebraska, Montana and South Dakota, where I think perhaps someone else might win, maybe a Ted Cruz. That's probably a common sense thing to do. But then what I've deliberately left out there is California and Pennsylvania. And what this seems to suggest to me is that without winning California, or without winning lots of delegates in California, without winning lots of delegates in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump can't get to that magic number. I mean, do you agree with that analysis? You know, it feels like California is the main place where the Never Trumps can stop him.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a, you know, a populous state with a huge, you know, delegate count. It's not, as I understand it, winner takes all. It's quite possible that he would, you know, even if he was to win it, he's not going to take all 172 delegates. I mean, I think it's fair to say that if he was to take the majority of the California delegation, then he's probably going to be, if not on the money, then very, very close. I'd say that, you know, California, you know, getting more than, say, 60% of the vote in California would mean that he's kind of probably got enough delegates. I think our cousins on 538 did, you know, a big panel where they interviewed a number of different people, you know, experts on this kind of thing. And they reckoned that, you know, Trump was coming up just short, even when you include California. So, you know, it's just to me that, you know, I think it's going to be interesting, but my hunch is that something will happen in terms of either Kasich or Cruz, that they'll drop out or they will discreetly ensure that he gets the nomination. Mm. One thing that's interesting, worth bearing in mind, is the convention's going to be in Cleveland. Does John Kasich really want to be the governor hosting a convention that's going to be contested, that's going to have loads and loads of protesters there, almost regardless of who wins, presuming it's not going to be him? Mm. That, you know, and if some weird thing happens and Trump wasn't to be the nominee, you know, you can imagine it being a spicy situation, shall we say.
He was promised riots.
But I mean, you know, does he want that, or would he actually prefer it to be, you know, to be relatively less controversial, and for, you know, Trump to be there, to go there to be crowned, rather than to have to seize it with his sort of you know, in a more muscular way, shall we say.
I mean, Lee, I'll bring you in here. I mean, how important do you think this 1237 number is? We were talking off air about how, you know, ultimately, you know, it's a symbolic number, but it's not the be-all and end-all, is it?
Yeah, I think there's a case that we might need to take a step back here and just think, well, look, 1237 gives him the guarantee that he's going to be top of the ticket. But the thing is, I think it's fair to say he is very obviously going to come into the convention at least having the plurality, if not having the majority. So I think we're possibly getting to the point of sort of angels dancing on pins, of wondering exactly whether or not he crosses the line. I mean, you made a point in one of the previous episodes, Kieran, that Trump could always approach Cruz and say, look, I'll make you my running mate if you give me your delegates. Now, if we assume that that's realistic and that Cruz would go for it, then it seems to me that this 1237 question doesn't actually matter all that much. But raises a question to Rob's point about Kasich, and if he's in a position to be wanting to, as you say, organise a coronation rather than a contest, then is he potentially looking at that question as well?
I mean, Rob, what do you think? It seems like, you know, Ted Cruz is the only person that can viably win a plurality of the delegates, even if we think that's likely. But it does just feel like it's inevitably now Trump's going to have that plurality, does a deal before the convention, game, set, match.
Well, I think we have to look at what Trump really wants out of this. I mean, I think no presidential nominee really wants to have their hands tied and their decision taken away with them and away from them. I think it's not completely clear which wing of the Republican Party it is that Trump wants to bring on board. There's an argument which says that, you know, Cruz supporters, lots of them potentially relatively sit relatively more in his camp than others. It might be that someone a bit more moderate, or perceived to be a bit more moderate, someone who has actually already endorsed him, like Chris Christie, would be a preferred running mate. I mean, I don't know whether that's, you know, what he's actually thinking. But, you know, picking a running mate is often about, you know, party unity, about ensuring that you maximise the turnout of your own voters and maximise, you know, the appeal of the ticket as a whole with different audiences.
He's torn up all the rules so far, hasn't he?
Well, this is true. This is absolutely true. But I'm just not convinced what Cruz necessarily adds to a Trump ticket. Without being, you know, rude, it's already got the, you know, quite a lot of the ingredients there with Trump.
I mean, let's look ahead to the general election. Obviously, we had horrible scenes yesterday in Brussels with the terrorist attacks. At the time of recording, the BBC saying more than 30 dead and hundreds injured. Inevitably, in a political cycle, this leads to discussion of what this means for the presidential race, for politics over here. Let's focus on the US for now. obviously both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton addressing this issue on the stump. This leads to a debate amongst pundits and political scientists watching this in terms of, you know, what impact will this have on the race? Do voters turn to the strongman, to Donald Trump, who's, you know, running around, throwing his weight about, saying how he's going to fix ISIS and we need to be tougher and all this sort of thing? And also, he's the Republican in the race. Historically, the argument goes when it's a foreign policy election, the Republicans do well. So is this going to, for want of a better phrase, benefit his campaign? Or would we see voters looking towards Hillary Clinton, who's the experienced politician, who's been there in, you know, as a senator and as a Secretary of State, and as the safe pair of hands, which she obviously wants to be? Leo, you were looking at some of the polling around this, weren't you?
Yeah, so after the Paris attacks, Trump's numbers really started improving quite quickly. They'd been flatlining for a while before that. So the temptation is, I think, to say exactly as you did, that people will look to him and look to quite an aggressive strongman sort of approach. But what we've got to remember is, so far we've really only been seeing how Trump performs amongst GOP voters. Now we've got to start looking at the national polls. And when we look at those, the picture is just so different from anything that we've seen in terms of contests that Trump has fought. So just looking at a couple of national polls, there's a YouGov poll for The Economist that put on the metric of ready to be commander-in-chief, Hillary is about even, ready, not ready. Trump is minus 30. So that's a huge gap. Washington Post ABC poll, the right temperament to be president. Hillary plus 18, Trump minus 47. And to handle terrorism head-to-head, Hillary's got a 14-point lead. So it feels that the way people perceive the candidates at the moment, if terrorism becomes more of an issue, counterintuitively, that doesn't necessarily help Trump as much as we might think.
I suppose it's an unconventional race. I mean, Rob, what's your take on Hillary Clinton and foreign policy? Because obviously, you know, the conventional Republican campaign was to go big on things like Benghazi and her experience in the State Department and to try and almost make that a weakness. But as Leo says, it seems like it's quite difficult for the Republicans to win on foreign policy. Or do you think actually there is a potential for the Republicans' traditional lead as a party on this to, dare I say, Trump Clinton?
Well, yeah, I mean, so there's several things going on there, right? First of all is, I think, the way we started on this, which is it going to be an election about security or about, you know, bread and butter, you know, issues of the economy and jobs? And ironically, I think in many ways, an economy and jobs thing, you know, we've seen Trump, a large part of Trump's appeal amongst, you know, disaffected white working class voters is, you know, the stuff about trade with China and, well, trade more broadly and, you know, bringing jobs back home and why, you know, that both, well, Clinton specifically, in terms of Bill Clinton, but, you know, Democrats and the elite of the Republican Party more broadly have, in his, you know, to his mind and to the minds of his supporters, screwed over a substantial proportion of his, you know, electorate, if you like. Now, that changes the picture quite a lot. I mean, Ross Perot ran on a similar kind of platform in the 90s, you know, and split the vote because there was also a traditional Republican candidate in the race. But, you know, in the last, certainly the last two elections, three elections, we've not seen anything like that coming up. So that definitely changes the tables. I think, personally, everybody loves talking about Benghazi, but people are sick of hearing about it. There's nothing new there.
It's not converting the swing, maybe. I mean, it animates the base of the Republican Party.
Also, it's a really complicated issue to do with, you know, a mission that people don't necessarily understand. There's just a bunch of stuff in there that is really complicated, and the full facts, I think, it's unlikely that they'll ever come out. And I certainly don't think any new... I was going to use the word explosive, which is inappropriate, isn't it? But, you know, I don't think anything, you know, brand new is going to come out during the campaign.
Well, one of the things about that is it's priced in. People have heard about this already. And, I mean, you know, again, back to these polls, another thing that struck me, Hillary's favourability minus 6. That's bad. But Trump's minus 37. So, I mean, you know, people have already heard all this stuff about Hillary. They've heard the stuff about the emails. I mean, are her numbers really going to go lower because of those? Yeah. I mean, something else, perhaps. But how are those going to do much more damage than they already have?
But also, like, Trump's foreign policy is really confusing, right? I mean, because bits of it are very much about sort of retreating into a kind of America alone kind of dream of reversing global trade
building
deals,
walls.
Building walls, you know, not taking part in wars that you can't win and being a world's policeman anymore, and sort of elements of the Ron Paul kind of idea of American sort of foreign policy and the sort of Pax Americana being an unsustainable and unfundable dream. But on the other hand, he wants to, like, beat the crap out of everyone.
It's like he's George W. Bush in 2000 and George W. Bush in 2002.
Yeah. If anyone can do it, Donald Trump can do it. Well, that's all we've got time for the first part. We'll be revisiting some of these topics in the coming weeks. Certainly it looks like with New York around the corner, Trump and Clinton are looking in a very strong position for their respective nominations. Well, that's all we've got time for part one of the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters show this week. In part two, join us in a moment when we'll be talking about events closer to home. Welcome back to the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters show, where we're going to be talking about events closer to home in part two. I'm joined once again by Leo Barassi and Rob Vance. Certainly a tumultuous week in British politics this week, with Ian Duncan Smith's resignation causing something of a crisis at the heart of the British government. Meanwhile, Labour seem to be taking a lead in the opinion polls. We'll be discussing just how important that is. But of course, the events in Brussels yesterday cast a long shadow over all of this. Chaps, we were talking before the break about the sort of impact of the events in Brussels on events across the pond. But what do we think about events closer to home? Obviously, there's the EU referendum campaign. One of the key elements of that campaign seems to be a debate about national security and, you know, what are the conditions under which we are safer. I mean, Rob, what's your perspective on the impact things like Brussels could have to that debate, if at all?
So my recollection from what happened over Paris was not dissimilar to what Leo was saying regarding the States. I mean, the impression that I have is that there's a kind of short-term tactical card to be played by a certain bunch of people who are in favour of leave, which is actually quite difficult to play and actually I think is often counterproductive. So the argument runs, there's been a terrorist attack, this then provokes people to think about security and borders and immigration, and therefore this plays into the hands of those that want to leave. I think that probably is a classic example of an argument that plays out very well with the sort of core of, or the most, for sake of argument, you know, fanatical of those that want to leave, or some of them. I'm not suggesting for a second to everybody. But actually, when you look at what the concerns of the swing voters, the undecided, those in the middle that are persuadable, actually, and this is a bit like the sort of Farage-Marmite argument, I'm not saying for a second that Farage is exploiting anything like this, but it's a similar kind of argument that actually that's a real, really off-putting, that actually that plays out in a very different way. The opposite reaction happens of saying, that's not really why I want to be voting in the referendum in a certain way. And actually reinforces some of the authority and kind of measured kind of statesmanlike, you know, appeal of David Cameron saying, actually, we need to remain in security first. So I think the long term answer is it's probably has a minimal impact. In the short term, though, I think we might see some kind of, you know, as it were, stronger rhetoric coming out of certain groups. And that might play out to a certain extent with some of the groups who are already convinced of remaining being perhaps, you know, more strident.
It's interesting you mentioned the kind of enthusiasm of different sides, because isn't that the problem we've got with polling this referendum, is that we don't quite know what turnout's going to be. So even if you're only sort of preaching to the choir on this issue, maybe preaching to the choir is enough to get your enthusiastic voters out.
It's an even worse two-ball problem than usual, because, yeah, you have some sense from general election to general election of if it's a close result, you know, there's A, long-term trends, B, you know, depending on how close the result is expected to be, that affects turnout. So you can have a reasonably good idea of what's going to happen. Referendum, I mean, really, nobody really...
In a way, I suppose, because we're so attuned to thinking constituencies and thinking about swing voters and thinking about marginal constituencies, perhaps our brains, as it were, aren't really wired that well to think about a national referendum and actually the value of turning out your base. So I wonder, from what Rob's just said, actually whether... In a purely polling and electoral sense, sort of what might come in the EU referendum as a result of this is not much for most people, but actually for the base of the Leave camp, this is something that they can use to mobilise their base, and possibly that's something that actually does help them more significantly than we might tend to think in parliamentary elections.
It's possibly like London, which we'll come onto in another episode, but you know, you don't have to win Islington as the swing state to win London, do you? You just weigh your vote wherever you can get it. So ultimately, if you stack up certain votes in certain places...
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of the AV referendum. I was out campaigning in Dalston.
What's that?
Well, if I say I was campaigning in Dalston and it was we were getting 75% support, I think you can guess which side I was there for. But it's sort of, in a way, normally that would feel ridiculous, but the point is, in a national referendum like this, it, you know, is actually quite useful.
Let's talk about the sort of wider political implications, because You know, obviously, we've had a very difficult week for the Conservative Party this week. Ian Duncan Smith's resignation catching people by surprise, I think it's fair to say. The narrative, Rob, seems to be that this is a big problem for George Osborne and his potential ambitions. I think there was a poll out this week by YouGov, we've got it here, which showed, you know, a lot of scepticism about whether either whether George Osborne is up to the job of being Prime Minister, both amongst sort of the voters overall, but Conservatives, and also whether it's likely to happen. Looks pretty bad for him, doesn't it, if he wants to take over from David Cameron?
Well, it suggests that he's unpopular with a significant proportion of Conservative supporters, and I think we've probably seen that that might well be true in terms of Conservative MPs. But I'm never really convinced by this up to the job, not up to the job, as a sort of, that's not the choice that people have. You know, the choice that people have arguably is, at best, is George Osborne a better or worse Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn? Or even more importantly, amongst Conservative voters, is he a better or worse choice than Theresa May, Boris Johnson and so
but
on?
But
so
actually,
forth.
Rob, something that I want to say on that, that this is not Conservative voters, it's Conservative members. And
sorry,
the problem with this... But that's important, because and I assume that this... That when it's saying Conservatives here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume this is amongst Conservative voters. And just like we're seeing now of Labour polls, you see very big difference in Labour voters' attitudes to Jeremy Corbyn and Labour members' attitudes to Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah,
and what we don't know, as far as I'm aware, is really what Conservative members think about the candidates. Now, we've had straw polls, essentially, on, I think, by Conservative nothing that's quite the same as this.
I mean, Leah, you've been looking at some analysis on George Osborne's personal ratings on your blog, Noise of the Crowd, haven't you? Because I guess, ultimately, when you're going to explain this, it seems like his reputation isn't quite as simple as how popular or unpopular he is.
Yeah. Essentially, we've had quite a strong narrative amongst political commentators that Osborne was really unpopular. He had the omnishambles budget. He was booed at the Paralympics. Everyone hated him. And then, essentially, to put it crudely, he got a haircut. He went on a few runs. He started wearing a hard hat and putting
voice
on
coach.
High-vis voice coach. And then everyone started really liking him again. And people pulled out polls to back this up, and it sort of felt from the polls, yep, that's exactly what we saw.
And then
in the last year, the narrative goes, he started getting unpopular again. He started making mistakes. Now, and again, the numbers showed this. But what I did was compared this to two things. First, I compared it to economic optimism. So there aren't a huge number of polls on this, but Mori regularly poll economic optimism and net satisfaction with the Chancellor of the day, and what I found was you got a really strong correlation. When people think that the economy is going badly, they don't like Osborne. When they think the economy is going well, they like Osborne. And the numbers track pretty well. I mean, we see it on the chart. Essentially, at the moment, we're getting the black line. Economic optimism is falling, and lo and behold, satisfaction with Osborne is falling. I suspect we might see a brief blip that is related to his current performance, but the stronger prediction is economic optimism. The other thing I looked at is not net satisfaction with his performance in the job, but favourability to him, essentially to people like him. Mm. And what I found is even more strongly than these two track, favourability to Osborne tracks favourability to Cameron almost perfectly. Cameron's about 10, 15 points higher. But basically, people's view of Osborne outside the circles of the small numbers who watch Westminster very closely is essentially he is a member of the government who I think I like slightly less than that main guy. And essentially, they move in the same way. So when you see Osborne's numbers falling, the chances are the government's numbers as a whole are falling. When they're rising, chances are the government's numbers as a whole are rising.
You made a good point, which is that ultimately who succeeds David Cameron isn't going to be anything to do with the British public. It's going to be down to what the Conservative members think. And it looks like the Conservative membership is pro-Brexit and is going to probably endorse a candidate that gets to the ballot that is pro-Brexit.
I think that's true to an extent, but then everybody said that David Davis would beat Cameron, and I think certain part of Cameron's appeal was the idea that he was, and it's, even if like politically maybe he was in a slightly different place to the central gravity of the membership, that he played well at the box office, that he was likable and that he was...
Is that though what happens in the party that's been out of power for 8 years or however long it had been at the time?
Quite. And so runs the argument, in the Labour Party, right, that the next time round there'll be another feel-good leader, but the leader after that might be one that's, as it were, closer to the centre of, gravity.
I want to come on to Labour in a moment, not quite yet, but if we look at Theresa May, she's someone whose position I'm quite interested in, because she was someone that was very popular amongst the grassroots. We talked about Con Home polls a moment ago. I think before Christmas, she was leading. And yet she's come out for Remain and has been very, very quiet. And I just wonder... I was talking to a colleague about this at work, and we were sort of thinking, so is she basically trying to be the kind of take the Osborne spot, assuming he crashes and burns and doesn't want to stand? Does she then become the continuity candidate?
Yes. Yeah. I should give like a more interesting answer than that. Keeping your head down, being seen as loyal to the current government, but not being, you know, the flamboyant Boris Johnson, who, you know, I think is polarised, you know, very, very popular, but also probably quite polarising, not being George Osborne. And I think that was her popularity with, you know, the Conservative home audience, that, you know, they didn't
the
like
Iron
Osborne.
Lady too.
They weren't modernised, you know, she's not a moderniser, but she's also kind of moderate, if you like.
It's one of these terrible things that people say about women when they're being nice to them in job reviews that men don't get so much, is she's a safe pair of hands, and that's probably one of the positions that she's going for.
It's like Alistair Campbell and Margaret Beckett, isn't it? I mean, this is the sort of, you know, lots of people like a safe pair of hands. I think it's a gender comment, I think you're right.
Yeah. Let's move on to Labour, because one of the noticeable, maybe under the radar trends, which we can just, I know Rob's cynical about this one, is that Labour have taken a lead in the polls, or certainly seem to be drawing neck and neck. Now, we saw an ICM poll.
I'd just like, for the record, obviously I'm ecstatic that the party that I'm, you know, a lifelong member of is, you know, leading in the polls. I'm just suspicious of what it means.
I think
really
that's the first time you've revealed you're a Labour member.
I'm shocked, Rob.
I'm sure our listeners will be.
I think it was implicit. But anyway, there was a poll last week for Martin Boone from ICM, poured a lot of his scorn on his own poll. I think they were neck and neck.
Didn't he also say that the date was wrong on the thing? So
no,
I can't remember. Yeah, but he put a lot of scorn on it and said, "Oh, you know, actually, we're not quite sure about this." So everyone kind of dismissed it. But then we've got this YouGov poll which shows Labour ahead.
So they're accidentally herding with each other.
Quote. This was last week. Now, this obviously has, you know, political implications, I suppose you could argue. Jeremy Corbyn, not being sort of 10 points behind in the polls, his supporters will say to members of the PLP that want to get rid of him, hang on a minute, we're pulling ahead, the government's in a shambles, you know, everything's going fine. Rob, how much significance would you place on the fact Labour is ahead at this stage, or looks like it's gaining ground?
I'm not that sniffy. I just think... there's an election in whatever it is 6 weeks' time, which will have a lot more information about what the public actually really think about the government and about, you know, Corbyn's in leadership of the Labour Party. I think it's one of those we saw in the lead up to 2010, the Conservatives having leads of kind of 10, 12, 15 points at the kind of same kind of juncture, or relative, you know, in the middle of the parliament at least. We saw Miliband with leads of what?
8 points 5 years ago.
Yeah. And actually, even then, even with 8 point leads, didn't rack up a huge number of council, of, you know, additional council seats versus, you know, the comparator point years previously. So I think it's one of those things where if they weren't neck and neck, then I think you'd be thinking Labour were going to be complete toast. Mm. I think the fact that they've got a 1 point lead well within the margin, that, you know, things that the bottom maybe isn't about to fall out of all, you know, Labour candidates' prospects and people aren't going to lose their deposits, does it mean that we're about to gallop home to, you know, hundreds of council seats? I don't see it personally.
I want to bring Leo in here. I mean, what's your take on that? It does seem like Labour are gaining ground, but isn't the thing that Jeremy Corbyn, you know, in terms of his leadership, isn't the thing that Jeremy Corbyn needs is ambiguity? Like, ultimately, doesn't look like there's going to be a smoking gun in terms of Labour members saying, OK, actually, you know, maybe a change is necessary.
Yeah, well, he'd like more than ambiguity, but I think... So I agree with everything that Rob said about bank it.
But the point is...
So the thing is, so I had Corbyn Easter taking me to task on Twitter the other day, sort of saying, look, everything you wrote...
I was about to say taking you to dinner.
Lovely. Everything one I wrote one. Ahead of Corbyn's election, saying that that this is going to be a disaster for Labour, is wrong, because, look, Labour are now ahead and there's momentum and they're taking the Tories down. And I think for me, it's the internal significance of this is far more important than the external significance, that people will, in my view, wrongly look at this as evidence that Labour are now beating the Tories and they are in a fighting position to win the next general election. As you know, as we know, 5 years ago, Labour 8 to 10 points ahead, and people who'd seen it before, and I was perhaps guilty of not paying enough attention to this wisdom, said, look, 10 points ahead at this stage of Parliament is not enough. Now, 1 point ahead is absolutely not enough on every historical precedent we've got.
But to play the devil's advocate argument, the difference in this contest is that there is going to be a new Prime Minister at some point during this Parliament. Now, I suppose you can take that a couple of different ways, can't you? You can say it's renewal and Boris Johnson comes in and wipes the floor with Labour. But yeah, you could also say that at the end of the day, if there's one thing that seems to be happening within the bases of certain political parties lately in America and Britain, the base doesn't seem to care too much about what the wider public think. Maybe the Conservatives pick an unpopular leader. Maybe there's financial difficulty or sort of other crises that really challenge this narrative of Conservatives being competent. And, you know, ultimately it's a zero-sum game. Could people reevaluate Jeremy Corbyn in the future? I mean, Rob, do you think Corbyn's, I mean, from your experience on this, are views of Jeremy Corbyn now set, or can you, or do you think he can change them?
I think there is an opportunity to change them. I don't think, you know, views are never 100% permanent. I think you can always do some things to change them. I think it's hard, not least because it's one thing to change the minds of, you know, voters who turn up and maybe pay a little bit of attention to politics when they're absolutely forced to because there's an election campaign going on and there's absolutely nothing else on the TV. There is, you know, to persuade them of a change could, you know, if they've had the Sun and the Mail and everything else screaming at them for the last 5 years that Jeremy Corbyn, is like 10 times worse than Ed Miliband. It's going to be pretty hard. The fact that they've also probably got like Labour candidates in their local papers being reported as saying that they don't, you know, they think Jeremy Corbyn is a terrible thing and all the rest of it. It's going to be hard, I think, to change perceptions, but not impossible. And also, I mean, I think at the moment that you can get pretty decent odds on Jeremy Corbyn not being the Labour leader at the next election. I think it sort of fluctuates around whether it's, you know, 50% likely. But I mean, that's reasonably unheard of for people to have that much doubt that the sitting leader of the major opposition party won't be the leader at the next election. So we could have two different people facing off in 2020. Or indeed, you know, this chat at the moment of, you know, the budget last week was this tactical masterstroke to try and, which I too kind of bought to an extent, for which I apologise. But, you know, that Osborne was planning an early election, you know, get a Brexit vote, don't get a Brexit vote, vote to remain. Cameron does a few things, some of them popular, some of them unpopular, and then Osborne takes over and calls a snap election before any of the painful bits or the most painful bits of the budget had to kick in.
And perhaps that was his plan.
Clearly. It may be less likely now, but, you know, those kind of, yeah. You know.
But, I mean, the other thing is, and, you know, talking about change of leader, because the Tories are only going to be putting two people up to the membership, and because they've seen what happened to Labour, it just doesn't feel to me like there is a really outlandish wild card who can come up. This isn't a case where we can see the membership picking someone completely from, I suppose, right field. It's going to be almost certainly at least one, probably two, of Osborne, May and Johnson. Possibly Gove, possibly Javid, but, you know, none of those are the sort of people who suddenly they go up against whoever's Labour leader.
One of the people that have been mentioned, I suspect anybody that gets any vague promotion in the next couple of years is going to be cited at least briefly.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing will be, like, who the continuity Cameroon effectively is, whether that coalesces behind, well, as we were discussing earlier, Theresa May, who's kind of, you know, in a sense moderate but not, you know, part of the project in the same way as Osborne or Javid or, Crabb.
Mm. Well, that's all we've got time for today. I'm Rob and Leo. Thanks very much for your time. That's all we've got time for this week's politicalbetting.com polling matters show. Certainly lots of events covered. In the coming weeks, we're going to be looking in more detail at some of the local elections and devolved elections and what to look out for in our upcoming sort of electoral cycle, but also keeping a close eye on whether Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton really is inevitable. Certainly seems that way. There's only so many times we can doubt it, but yeah, we'll be keeping a close eye on that in the future. So stay tuned, and thanks for watching, and thanks for listening.